Welcome to Let's Talk About Obesity Care, a podcast series from Let's Go. The series is focused on thought-provoking and informative conversations to support medical providers interested in obesity prevention and treatment. I'm your host, Carrie Gordon, a pediatric nephrologist turned childhood obesity treatment physician. I am a clinical advisor to Let's Go, a childhood obesity prevention program of the Barbara Bush Children's Hospital, and a practicing specialist at Maine Medical Center's Weight and Wellness Program in lovely Portland, Maine. Today, we're talking about insulin resistance and diabetes in patients with obesity. We have Dr. Michael Dedekian joining us. I'm really excited to welcome him. He's a board-certified pediatric endocrinologist at Maine Medical Center with expertise in general endocrinology and diabetes, as well as childhood obesity and lipid disorders. Welcome, Mike.
Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
Well, why don't we just jump right in? And why don't we start by talking a bit about how the incidence of type 2 diabetes has changed over the course of your time in practice? I know we're seeing it more often, and I think there's also potentially some increased incidence with COVID infection.
That's right. Yeah, I remember being a pediatric resident in the early 2000s thinking to myself that obesity and type 2 diabetes was going to define our career as pediatricians moving into the new millennia. And it really has. It's amazing. I mean, type 2 diabetes was unheard of or very rare 30, 40 years ago. And now it's just part of the bread and butter of what we do every day. So the incidence has been rising steadily over time. Depends on what part of the country that you live in. But in some of our more affected areas, up to a third of all kids with new onset diabetes have type 2. In some areas, it's higher than that. And yes, during COVID, incredibly, the incidence of pediatric type 2 diabetes has skyrocketed. I know, as you know, in your clinic, and I see in my clinic as well, some reports as high as 150% increased incidence, 170% increased incidence. It really is amazing. And yeah, why that's happening is an area of discussion. Is that, should we talk about that a little bit, about why we think that's going on?
Sure, that would be great.
It's probably multifactorial. We don't think it's direct causation from COVID necessarily, just talking about type 2 diabetes here, but with more kids at home, more sedentary time, disruption in usual routines, less physical activity, we think all of those things play a role in the emergence of type 2, lack of access to medical care, exacerbation of social determinants of health and health disparities during COVID. All of those things have probably played a role. Many kids coming in with type 2 diabetes need to be hospitalized for DKA or severe hyperglycemia, and that also is fairly unusual in the pediatric type 2 population. And that probably has to do with lack of access to our usual medical care that we get. So huge issue, a little bit surprising that that was the case during COVID, but we have a ton more kids now with type 2 that we follow.
Yeah, it is interesting. I mean, I suppose this is in parallel, obviously, with we're seeing, you know, an increased incidence of obesity during the pandemic, and especially increased incidence of worsened obesity in people with more severe obesity. And of course, that would align well with, you know, why we'd be seeing more type 2 diabetes and so much less activity, you know, with, you know, team sports being down and all that.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. Well, you know, the role of insulin certainly extends beyond blood sugar control and just type 2 diabetes. You know, we spoke with Dr. Russell about NASH, and I know it's, you know, involved obviously in PCOS. It influences appetite in the energy regulatory center in the brain. How do you describe some of this physiology and interconnectedness of these conditions to patients or parents in a way that just isn't overwhelming?
Yeah, some understanding of how it all works, I do think, is important. So you're right about that. I talk about insulin as a hormone that helps us, as you say, not just with blood sugar, but really helps us with our overall metabolism and appetite control and weight also. And we know insulin resistance is a key piece of the pathophysiology of obesity. Insulin resistance at some degree is usually always present. So what we explain to families is, you know, insulin is a hormone that's supposed to be there to help you with your blood sugar and your metabolism. And if you're getting insulin resistant, insulin's working a second shift or a third shift, and it's kind of doing all this overtime stuff to keep your body in balance. And when that burns out, you can't do that, you start to get high blood sugars and evolve to diabetes. So I think some understanding of insulin is important. And then we do what I'm sure you do in the clinic is tie that to how can that inform some of the health choices that we make? Because I don't think anybody argues that getting insulin levels down in someone is helpful. And if it's because you're eating less refined carbohydrate, is usually going to result in your BMI looking better. So I think discussing insulin in general terms that people can understand is definitely important. You mentioned too, insulin as a medicine. And yeah, I think something we forget about is that a side effect of insulin is weight gain. We talk about hypoglycemia all the time. On the short term, of course, that's the side effect we're worried about the most, low blood sugar. If we didn't have low blood sugar, we'd probably give huge doses of insulin all the time to control people's diabetes. But you have to worry about hypoglycemia on the short term. But longer term, insulin, we explain to families, is a building hormone. It tells you to build and store things away. So the more insulin that you're on, the more obesogenic or weight promoting that tends to be. So it's really late in the game in type 2 physiology that insulin is required. It's a bad sign if a kid needs insulin for type 2 diabetes. It means their disease has progressed pretty far or overlapped with type 1 diabetes and autoimmunity. It can be quite challenging to help insulin resistance and weight if someone is on large doses of insulin.
Yeah, you know, it also speaks to the importance of considering bariatric surgery and type 2 diabetes before patients get to the point of needing insulin. You know, it's probably part of the reason why, you know, kids with type 2 diabetes have better chance of coming off medications than even adults who've had bariatric surgery with type 2 diabetes.
Right. Yep. So the stakes are definitely high. Diabetes is something, of course, the younger you get it, the worse you're going to do over the course of your life, because many of the issues with micro and macro vascular disease and nephropathy and neuropathy and retinopathy, those are all progressive things. So if you have diabetes for 5 years, you're going to be okay probably. But if you have diabetes for 30 years or 50 years or 60 years, the chances of those complications becoming a problem go way up. It's also worth saying that we think of diabetes as having a different phenotype in young people compared to adults. A lot of this was brought to light with the now relatively famous Today studies that were done on type 2 diabetes in youth. And we know that type 2 diabetes in kids is more severe and more aggressive. So it tends to progress to needing insulin faster, and it tends to respond to oral agents less well than in adults. So it's not just that it's the diabetes comes early, it's that the pathophysiology of it, which we're still untangling, it seems to be different in young people.
So Mike, we have some newer tools to treat type 2 diabetes in a way that can also help with obesity. What's your experience been with some of the newer medicines like the GLP-1 agonists? You know, what's the right time to start them? Do we have to wait for A1Cs over 6.5? What do you think?
Yeah, the GLP-1 agonists are an exciting group of medications, and our experience in pediatrics with them is building. There's a couple of approved indications, as you know, for type 2 diabetes, but also for obesity in young people. At least in my own experience, we were not involved in any of the clinical trials here at Barbara Bush Children's Hospital. But in my own experience, I still feel like I'm very much at the beginning of using these medications. We've been using them more over the past year to 2 or 3 years, perhaps. I think they can certainly be helpful. They are sometimes a nice alternative for someone with more mild diabetes to insulin. And occasionally we've had patients who were on modest doses of insulin, maybe doing better with their BMI, better with their diabetes management, that we could wean off of insulin and use a GLP-1 instead. So we're starting to do that. But at least in my own experience, we're still on a learning curve with it. I don't have enough patients on them to be able to draw any of my own firm conclusions with my own experience. But certainly the data that's out there on improvement in glycemic control and improvement in weight, always balancing against the common GI side effects caused by these medications, which is a limiting factor for some patients. I'm encouraged, but I think we have to do more to see how efficacious they're going to be.
Yeah, I agree. I also have a handful of patients on these medications. Really, the limitation we're facing oftentimes when we're using it for obesity is insurance coverage, even though it's, FDA approved, I believe now for over 12 for obesity and over 12 years for obesity in kids. Not every insurance company is paying for it. And the obesity treatment doses ideally would be a little higher than the diabetes treatment doses. But I agree that, I've had a number of kids I've tried to use it on who haven't tolerated it from the GI side effect standpoint. But then I have definitely had a number of patients have pretty incredible response, being able to articulate, young kids being able to articulate like, boy, this is one of the first times I've actually felt full, which is, it's exciting, allowing people to be able to make healthier choices in a way that feels like less of a struggle.
Very exciting. And it really is a new era in how we think about medication treatment as well. Before a very specific agent like liraglutide, we sort of had workarounds, stimulants and other things that we would use to moderate appetite. But this is really something that is directly affecting, we think, the neuroendocrine pathways that control appetite and weight. And I think in the future, as time rolls along, there's a couple of other things in the pipeline, we're going to continue to figure out how to manipulate that neuroendocrine access to help people with weight and appetite and metabolism. And that's really exciting. So I think we're kind of just at the beginning of this medication and others like it coming along, being part of our toolbox.
Yeah, I agree. And, unlike the, using metformin, there's no, it doesn't have any potential liver toxicity, at least not as a common side effect. And, when we have kids with elevated liver enzymes, in addition, to having insulin resistance and, hyperphagia and, being able to have an agent that might help a little bit with overall health in this way is great. And George Russell shared a educational video with me around adult provider gastroenterologist speaking on fatty liver, and they have looked at adults with fatty liver, and liraglutide is one of the promising agents, in terms of treatment, only obviously associated when it was associated with weight loss. So I think, like you said, it gives you the feeling that we're going to have a lot more tools moving forward.
Absolutely. Yep. That's great.
I think we probably should be doing more surgery in our patients with bariatric surgery in our patients with type 2 diabetes. And this is definitely been a struggle I've had in clinic, as finding the right way to talk to patients about it and helping people understand the benefits of it, and in general the fact that it's a relatively safe surgery when you're comparing it to long-term risks of potentially of diabetes. Are you talking to your patients about bariatric surgery in clinic? Is that coming up for in endocrinology?
We do talk about it some. A lot of it we leave up to you in your clinic. I think we talk about it some. I think there's such awareness of bariatric surgery now in the general public. Many kids we follow, they have a parent or family member who has had bariatric surgery, or who at least has investigated it. That it's something a lot of families know about, and sometimes they'll ask us. As you know, finding a family that and a patient that is going to be successful with the surgery, it's not an easy road, is essential. So we want to make sure we've got the right kind of family that is interested. But yes, I mean, the short answer to your question is yes, we do talk about that as something that is out there and something that we think about, especially if type 2 diabetes that we're seeing in clinic is very severe and not under good control or requiring large doses of insulin, that certainly raises the stakes.
Yeah, I think that there is still, as much as there information out there about bariatric surgery, I still get the sense from patients when I bring it up that there isn't the sense that it's, you know, a metabolic surgery. People really think of it as being most effective because of how it makes the stomach smaller, not really understanding how it can really allow patients to keep the weight off that they've lost because of all the metabolic changes. And I think when families start to understand that, sometimes that's when you see the light switch go off, like, okay, maybe this is something I'll think about.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And I think I took for granted with my earlier comments that when we do talk about surgery, we say exactly that. We talk about how it's less about the physical mechanical switching around of where things are or making the stomach smaller. But it's that it goes back to that neuroendocrine pathways and changing metabolism and in ways we don't fully understand why the surgery works as well as it does in many patients. So yes, absolutely. Framing it as a metabolic surgery is very important. I agree.
Yeah. Well, we probably should also talk about lifestyle, not just metabolic surgery, right? Can you talk a bit about low carbohydrate diets and their utility in the setting of insulin resistance and maybe the impact of exercise?
Yeah, I mean, of course, it goes without saying that those still are among our most powerful tools, if not the most powerful tools in our toolbox. They're just really hard to administer to patients. But I'm a low carb guy, and you know, low carb has many definitions. It depends what you're talking about. I think when I am talking about it, I mean, just in general terms, reducing our refined carbohydrates, reducing our overall total grams of carbs in the day that we eat. I don't talk about ketogenic diet or prescribe that to our patients, although can be very effective. And I think we need more studies and research on ketogenic diet, but that is such a difficult diet to do to actually get to the point of ketosis. So when I say low carbs, I'm talking just normal healthy eating where we hope the total carbohydrate is not 300 grams of carbs per meal, as it is in so many of the kids and patients that we follow. So If we think of insulin resistance and insulin as a key player, a key operator in the pathogenesis of obesity, if you get that insulin level down, you should start to do better. And the way to get it down is to reduce carbohydrate and eat a balanced diet with protein and healthy fat and fiber. So it's critical. I mean, I'm speaking as a very biased sugar doctor, right? I'm a diabetes doctor. So of course we care about the carbohydrate maybe more than other people do. And there's other diets that work, but most diets, if you look at them, no matter what they're called, it doesn't include refined carbohydrate as a big component. So we know if we lower carbs, we'll lower insulin, we can get on a path to weight loss. I've never seen it not work if families are doing it. But as you and I struggle with every day, we're in a carb-rich environment, and it's difficult for a myriad of reasons to get families on the right path with nutrition. Sometimes simply because so much yummy food is around and it's hard to avoid, and other times because economically and psychosocially, that's the food that's available, and there's may not be a lot of other choices. So you do more work in that space than I do. So absolutely. And then you mentioned exercise. Everybody knows exercise is good for you. You know why it's good. One reason is that your glucose transporters start to proliferate in the membrane of muscles and other tissues when you exercise. So your muscles become sponges for sugar, even without insulin being around. That's an insulin independent effect. They become sponges for sugar when you exercise. And then for hours and hours and hours after exercise, your muscles are still taking up sugar more efficiently. So we sometimes talk about that as improved insulin sensitivity, but really it's because your glucose transporters are more plentiful in your muscles. So if we can get kids to exercise any amount of time, 5 minutes, 15 minutes, of course we aim for an hour or more a day, but anything is going to help improve things. Not to mention all the cardiovascular and mental health benefits of exercise and bone health and a zillion other things that exercise does to keep us healthy. But from a diabetes point of view, it's essential. We always think of there being three treatments for diabetes, or I try to teach that to patients. You have food, you have exercise, and you have insulin for diabetes. If you need to be on insulin, a lot of other medications available, but you know, there's prescriptions, there's exercise, there's food.
I find the topic of exercise, we did do a podcast kind of just focusing on exercise. This is, I think it's definitely a way we're failing our kids with the, oftentimes the school focus on exercise is so much around who's the best athlete and encouraging those kids to exercise. And how do we get people to learn that moving their bodies is something that ideally would be incorporated into their day-to-day life for their whole lives? You know, programs that have activity in schools before the school day also shows just improved school performance and less behavioral problems, not to mention all the things you talked about. Almost any of the consequences of obesity can be improved with moving our bodies more.
Exactly. Yep. No doubt.
No doubt. And as you talked about before, the, you know, the low carb diets, I mean, you know, the hyperpalatable foods, no doubt about it, are they're always carb containing in addition to usually some sodium and fats. And I think the foods that people tend to crave, you know, tend to be very, very, very high in carbohydrates. And these hyperpalatable foods that, you know, are essentially mostly processed foods, they can have a real strong pull on our patients and really trying to help them understand, you know, how to break free from some of that it'll be wonderful when we have more tools. And I do think some of these medications that help lower appetite can give kids back a little bit more control over some of these foods.
Absolutely. And you know, we're all only human. I always say to my patients, if someone brings a box of donuts to the office, like I'm having one, like it's there. how can you not have one? It's extraordinarily difficult, right? So we need to set up our food environments and be thoughtful about food that we bring to the office, food that we bring to schools, food that we put in our homes. If it's there, people are going to eat it. It's not a willpower thing. It's we're all just trying to get through our day. So the food environment is incredibly important as well. Another little thing I like to teach kids and parents too is the idea that carbs are foods that turn into sugar, into sweet sugar in your body. And that's not always understood. You know, people sometimes don't understand, nor would I expect them to, what the difference between a carbohydrate is and a sugar. So I think for our purposes of working with our families, they're the same thing. When you eat French fries, it turns into dessert in your body. And I think when we explain things that way, that something that doesn't necessarily taste sweet is still the same at the end of the day as something that is sweet is meaningful for families. If they think about it that way, sometimes that helps.
Yeah, no, I'm really glad you brought that up. I think again, I see that in clinic too. That can be confusing, and making sure people understand that is really key, because you don't want to move people away from one choice that's less healthy and have them think they're making a healthier choice and have it really have the same impact. It can, you know, be really disappointing for them and really frustrating.
Right. Hugely difficult, right? You could eat gluten-free organic food all day long that's nothing but refined processed carbohydrates. So it's a very challenging food environment that we live in.
Well, I wanted to, before we end, I did want to ask a little bit about the workup that you're doing for patients who have obesity and have an elevation in their A1C.
That is an excellent question. I'm glad you brought that up. So One part of my world that's very challenging is distinguishing between type 1 and type 2 diabetes. So when we have a patient who is presenting with elevated BMI, who is older, you know, older than 8 or 10 years old with new onset diabetes and an A1C that's 8% or 9%, say, they might or might not have classic polyuria, polydipsia. What do you do? How do you make the right diagnosis? So it routinely, we will send insulin and C-peptide. C-peptide is a little more specific usually a random sample. If we're evaluating a child, say in the emergency room or in the pediatric clinic on the same day in a more urgent way, we'll send those along with pancreatic autoantibodies. And there's 3 to 4 of those that we generally send. Because what we're looking for is, what is the insulin level? What is the blood sugar? We always want to exclude DKA, of course. So we'll, if it's a new onset patient, we're always looking at a blood gas and electrolytes and bicarb. And with that information, we usually can make a determination about whether type 1 or type 2 diabetes is present. So, for example, if your C-peptide, which is the little tag on human-made insulin that's in your body, that wouldn't be there from injectable insulin. So C-peptide, if that's high and your antibodies are negative, you don't have them, it's a pure insulin-resistant kind of picture. But if your C-peptide is high and you have 1 or 2 positive antibodies, you could have what's sometimes called double diabetes, that you'll see it with different names in the literature. So that means that there's a primary insulin resistance physiology that's, I like to say, it's dominant. We always think about what physiology is dominant right now. So if the insulin level is super high, well, we know you're insulin resistant, but if there's antibody positivity in the background, there's a chance that there's autoimmunity there as well, that may be contributing to relative insulin deficiency, or just simply means the kid is at risk of autoimmune type 1 diabetes developing independently on its own down the line. Whereas if we had a kid with a normal to low level of insulin and positive antibodies, that's more consistent with more of a pure type 1 diabetes picture. So those are some of the labs that we think of in diabetes, where we are always encouraging our colleagues to not be biased by the BMI, meaning if it's a overweight 16-year-old who comes in with acanthosis and they have new diabetes, you can't necessarily assume that it's type 2. You should usually get endocrinology involved and make sure you have the right diagnosis as you're figuring out treatment. So those are the things that we think of. And then, you know, you can probably speak to the other stuff that we do, but general screening kinds of things, we think about lipid profile, fatty liver disease, as you mentioned. Sometimes we think about vitamin D deficiency is a little higher in folks who have higher BMI, those kinds of things.
Yeah. And, you know, if you haven't been remembering to ask your patients about, you know, your female patients about their menstrual cycles, and, you know, it is not uncommon, you know, for us to be picking up PCOS in the obesity clinic, where it hasn't, sometimes it's been missed in the primary care office. And it's incredible how many kids that I've seen a big response to metformin for their PCOS, which is, you know, an aside, but related, obviously, as we're talking right about insulin resistance. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yep. And, you know, sometimes a OCP is a good medical choice. Sometimes metformin is a great medical choice. Both of those are, you know, top tier pharmaceutical options for PCOS. But I always remind people too, PCOS, at least in my opinion, in my style as a physician, it's a very personalized treatment. Yeah. So I try to find out what is important to our patients. Is it something with menstrual symptoms? Is it something with the signs of virilization, hair development, or acne? What is it that's important to them? And we tailor therapy to that. And just like we were talking about before, the real first line treatment for PCOS is lifestyle modification. That should always be front and center.
Well, I think this is a great way to end the podcast because it's reminding me of all the other podcasts you and I could do together to talk about all your other areas of expertise.
That's right. There we go.
So thanks so much for joining us and for all the work you do to take care of our patients in Maine.
All right, Carrie. Thanks so much.
You're very welcome.
Thanks for listening to Let's Talk About Obesity Care. You can find all of our episodes on your podcast app and on our webpage, letsgo.org. If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, we'd really love to hear from you. Please email us at info@letsgo.org. Let's Talk About Obesity Care is produced by Let's Go, with technical support from Maine Health Educational Services. Thanks so much for joining us.